Good morning, everyone. We'll start the hearings today with Mr. Brian Buckingham. So if Mr. Buckingham would like to come up, please. My name is Gail Rittenhouse, as I said previously, and I will be the lead on the hearing. And also participating in this hearing, we have the Honorable Michael Johnson to my right and the Honorable David Neal to my left. So thank you very much for everyone for being here. Mr. Buckingham, we'll start with a brief, just a brief summary. But if you would just come up to the podium here and state your name and your agency number. We'll get really started. Thank you.
Brian Buckingham, 084-965.
Thank you, sir. And we'll start with a short summary. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for excuse me just a moment, I'm just reading a note. And this reiterates what I just said earlier, and that is that people who were in support of the victim would exit this door and people in support of the inmate would exit that door. Absolutely. Thank you. So that's exactly what I just said earlier. So, okay. Anyway, back to the summary. You're here today for you've been certified by the Department of Corrections for a 412A home arrest or absolute discharge hearing. And you became eligible for these on August 16th, 2015. I've introduced you to the board. You were 47, is that right? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And you're serving a life sentence for the crime of murder in the first degree, and that occurred on August 15th, 1990, and you were 19 at the time?
Yes.
Okay. You were convicted via plea bargain on February 22nd, 1991, and sentenced on April 5th, 1991. Did you have an appeal? I have no indication there's an appeal. Okay. Okay. Do not know that you had any criminal history prior to that? Okay. And your discipline, your prison discipline history was minimal. You had one major ever, I think,
yes,
while you were in prison. And your last minor was in 2012, so you figured it out,
yes,
how to behave there. Is this your fifth hearing before the board? Fourth, fifth? Around, okay. I guess I could count them, but I think, I know I was at your last one, and I remember, so. And at that time, or in July 14th of 2016, you were granted home arrest.
Yes, 2016.
And, okay, and you've been on home arrest,
yes,
since then. Okay. All right. Let's see. Who else? You did some programming while you were in prison, and some it looks like you trained for food prep, masonry and cement work, some automotive work, some computer work. So you were trying to get some well-rounded skills. And you did participate, I see, in a victim impact panel while you were in prison. Okay. And did you take anger management, or have you taken
it?
Was that in prison or
both,
in that sense?
Inside and since I've been out.
Okay. All right, sir. Thank you. Let's see. What else can I say about this? I want to make note that we have both supporters for you today. It looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 supporters, as well as yourself.
Yes.
And then we also have, is it four people supporting on the side of the victim? Okay, thank you. So will all four of you want to speak today?
Three.
Three? Okay. And how about the seven supporters?
There'll be five total.
Five speaking? Okay, yeah. I'm not aware. Okay. All right, so we'll bring you up at the appropriate time when the time comes. All right. I think I've covered all of the general things. We need you to tell us a little bit about the crime, Mr. Buckingham. So tell us what happened that day, please.
It's definitely a long, wild story because it was very out of the moment.
out of the one of me, because I had no criminal history before portions of that incident. I was a very confused teenager. You know, I just turned 19 when I decided to leave the East Coast, where I've lived, and had never been out to the West Coast at all, to the West at all. And, you know, my goal of coming out here was, a very naive, idealistic, you know, teenage dream. I just wasn't fitting in, couldn't find my place, you know, after getting out of high school. And I just became very depressed and suicidal, and I just came up with this plan to come out here and live in the Rocky Mountains, like get off the land, get away from everybody for a while, meditate, and just try to figure things out. And, you know, so I got a motorcycle and provisions and some weapons to hunt with, and I came out here. And reality, you know, set in. I couldn't find the place that I had thought I was going to find, and I just became mentally and physically fatigued. And in the last bit of desperation, when I ran out of money, I used the weapons I had to rob a post office and shot and killed Miss Griggs, you know, for absolutely no reason. And, you know, and it's hard for me to you know, ever since even believe that I did something like that. But, you know, after the fact, you know, at the time I thought that's what I had to do, but immediately after that, you know, I was regret what I did, and I ended up turning myself in. And ever since, I've just, you know, made it a point that, well, you know, I wasted another life, I didn't want to. I didn't want to waste mine, so I really tried to be a better person. And, you know, and it's very hard to do in prison. And I have no violence, no threats, no assaults in prison. I really try to educate myself and try to be a better person. And that's what I've done since I've gotten out. I've continued you know, that mindset to be a good person and succeed. So, does that cover the incident? Not the 1990.
Okay, sir. And your record, as I discussed earlier, your record does reflect that you took, you took coursework to learn skills and such. So it does reflect, and your discipline record was very good. And for all the time, how many years were you in prison?
26 years.
So 26 years, and you have one major to show for it. So we believe me, we see many people who have quite a different record than that. So, okay, sir. So now you've been out since July, well, about almost exactly 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Double weeks shy of 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. So, so how was your adjustment? Tell us about your adjustment back to being out in society.
Well, I hope, you know, maybe a few of you have been able to look at the four pack that I did. I really want you to know me, I really have it. You know, 2 years is a lot of time. And as you know, someone getting out of prison after 26 years, there's a lot of obstacles. And you know, and I definitely, you know, faced those obstacles and worked day by day to you know, just to try to figure things out and move forward and as humble and as steadfast as I can. You know, I started out in Carter Vista on Gilbert, and I had never been to Phoenix, Gilbert, Mesa before, but I started out there and learned where I was and, you know, lived in a group home and participated in all the AA program, 12 steps, the group meetings, the all intensive program that was in that house, and then I, after 9 months in there, I got an extended stay hotel in Chandler while I was living on my own. And then eventually I found a very nice little two-bedroom apartment that I'm leasing in Mesa currently. That's where I live, me and my adopted cat that I have now. And, you know, I've also had steady employment. It took me about a month to secure employment in my first job after I was released. And I had one other month where I was in between jobs. But I'm currently employed with the same employer that I was last time I had a hearing. I'm still employed with the same employer.
And what kind of work are you doing? What are you doing for them?
I started out as a cook. It's in the cafe.
Okay.
Cooking in the golf course cafe. Mm-hmm. But now I've also run some stuff, and now I'm also doing a server, and I also run the register.
Oh, okay.
And pretty much everything involved in the cafe I take care of now.
Okay.
So
they're happy with you?
Oh, they're
happy
well,
with
yeah.
you. Okay. Oh, good. Well, that's always good.
Yeah.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
And did you have you had another job, or you had?
I've had three jobs.
But you're only working the one right now.
Right.
Okay. That was going to be. I didn't know if you were trying to do two jobs and balance that.
Right. Not currently.
Just one. Okay. Okay. What else? What do you do? What do you do for fun in your spare time?
As I tried to document in the packet, I've done a lot of things, out in, just socially. I've made a lot of new friends. I've never been from this area and, started from scratch. And my family is out in another state. They've come to visit me and we've gone out to, nature reserves and dinner with them. But I've also, sat with employees at company Christmas parties, and I still keep in contact with friends from the past two jobs. And one friend helped me move into my apartment. He had a truck and trailer, and helped me get some furnished a place from Goodwill and Half-Life Stay. Furnishing an apartment, and another friend has helped me figure out how to shop the deals better, at the grocery store, give me some tips, and I've done a lot of stuff. I'm really into music and stuff, so it's really nice to be able to play guitar again, and I started doing that. I've actually gone to a couple open mic places. Some songs, and also was involved in a drummer for a school rock band, adult band they had, and we had practices every week where we were working on this set of songs, and then we ended up playing this big concert at the end, so that was a good, that was really fun. Everybody had a great time with that. I've volunteered at a community band in Mesa. One job was a ping pong table, and we had great fun with employees who really loved, had a good competition of ping pong tournaments and stuff, had a great time. I've done a lot of, self-educating, and once I got my laptop and my phone, a good one, I started going to the Apple Store, has free classes on just about everything, how to use every device, how to use different programs on the device. And so I was going there every week to attend different classes on different things. And I've really, pretty up to date on all the technology stuff and going really good in that area. I've also completed the required DOC programs that they have assigned me, and also continued voluntary counseling. And currently see a counselor still on a voluntary basis about once a month, just to talk about whatever. And, I've progressed to really, quite a normal life, but still, it's restricted because, home arrest is really limits a lot of the activity that I can do. And, but I'm doing the best to within those parameters.
Okay, that sounds like you're trying to have a well-rounded life.
Yes.
Yeah, you're not just focused on one thing. And we do have a report from your parole officer, of course. And there is something in here about you had been working one place and hadn't made a disclosure to them that you were a felon. So can you tell us about that, and what did you learn from that experience?
I just want to let you know, I've been very conscientious about, doing what I'm supposed to do when I get out, and definitely take everything seriously and really try to do my best. But there are times, there's a lot of kind of ambiguous situations and gray areas here and there on some things, and I've had to really question my key at times and to figure out exactly what I got to do to follow things. And sometimes that kind of questioning is not taken. Trying to get clear in that particular situation was I had obtained a secondary job.
Right.
I've been working there for a few weeks,
right,
and training and stuff. And I had tended the same way I do every job. And there's a lot of variables in how I go in and present myself to the HR. A lot of these companies are very different in how they how you can talk to them. I've been with so many job interviews and stuff. It's tough to get these jobs. So I've tried many different things, I've tried taking and written things and explaining my history and stuff. And, I talked to the HR people. Some companies, they've flat out told me, I've tried to tell them, okay, I really need to tell you some stuff about my background. And they're like, I can't hear anything. I don't make those decisions. Corporate makes those decisions. So I went into all these things, but I always tried to, I never lied to any employers, I never tried to, deceive them. Always, but in this particular case, the company, I was, when I obtained this job, I told them, when I thought back about it, it was a natural conversation that I had with people, but I told them, or a manager, that I have, I'm on parole, and that you're probably going to get a call from my parole officer. Right? I've had three jobs before this one.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have to submit the, point of contact with the PO, and he's going to call down there, so I'm going to tell people that. And in that conversation, it usually ends up being a long conversation where they're going into a lot of my history and stuff, and some people, want to sidetrack the conversation, but I try to get out all the information that I, like I said, I've never been given really like a bullet point thing, like, here's exactly what you have to say.
Right.
Exactly. And so, in this particular incident, I couldn't remember actually stating my crime, but I remember stating, everything else, pretty much, the 26 years that I've been out, 15 years. And somehow the conversation got sidetracked. But also, like I said, I've never been told until after this incident that, that point is an exact point that I have to specifically, no matter what, any kind of, I have to really get that out. And so in that discussion, I was questioning the PO, about some of these ambiguities and stuff. And, I think he ended up having a different point of view on my attitude, was trying to make those questions and trying to clarify some of that ambiguity, And he kind of took it as, I felt like attacking me as like lying or something, or I felt like falsely accusing me of what I wasn't ever trying to do, and really serious about trying to do exactly what I'm supposed to do, and I know exactly what to do, And so, Meanwhile, he was saying that he was going to contact an employer and let him know, like I said, that he feels I was trying to do that on purpose or something. And I kind of felt that the guy was going to get me fired.
So they, you thought maybe they felt you were being evasive
right,
about
right,
it?
Right, right. And so, and that's what ended up happening. He called down there, and they called me back in to redo a background check.
Right.
And which they already did one.
So it was okay with them if you had been in prison, but not okay with the crime? Was that what your feeling was? The specific crime?
I'm not really sure because there must have been because I knew they were fully aware of how long I've been out, how long. Yeah, and I don't recall seeing the exact crime.
Okay.
The reason they came back with was. The official reason was that I have to be out 5 years before they consider hiring me. That was the official reason.
And sometimes it could be that's a corporate policy and local people don't know it.
Right.
You know, they don't really, or the corporate policy has changed or something. So it could be something like that.
Right.
But the atmosphere about having to disclose and it changes, you know, depending on what's going on in the world and in the country. Because you know you hear that sometimes people don't have to disclose, and sometimes they do. So that's just one of those things. But I hope that you think about that as you apply it more places. So you're prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sir. I'm going to see if fellow board members have any questions for you. Do you have any questions for Mr. Buckingham? Mr. Johnson has a question.
I just wanted to go back to the report on in the PO about getting upset. With the job, and I do understand, obviously, where you have taken some anger management, some different programming since you've been out. But tell me, how do you control that frustration? Because according to the information, it wasn't just a disagreement. The parole officer said you got upset with him, and when he told you you must disclose your past. And as a result of that, when it was disclosed, you did get terminated from that job. Is that right?
Well, I had already disclosed, so I was not. I had already disclosed everything, I guess, except for the exact crime.
Okay.
And then when he called down there, he clarified all those points, and then they called me in to do a background check. And then after that, I was terminated.
Okay.
They said because I can't be considered until after 5 years. So it was after a couple incidents that I was terminated. A couple. Steps.
So you were pretty frustrated, upset when that happened?
Yeah, it's very hard to get employment, and I'm definitely real anxious to be losing my job and frustrated that I'm accused, I sometimes got to stand up for myself a little bit, when there's certain ambiguities and I'm being accused of this when it's never really clear, and I'm trying to do, if I'm clear on certain points, I definitely follow all of them, it was just a bit of frustration is the way I would interpret my discussion with him. It wasn't personal with him. I feel that maybe he took it that way a little bit in his point of view. I was really just kind of frustrated with the ambiguity of kind of the situation with it. I've gone through it many times, and I know what they're going to call down there and check on this stuff, and I do my best to do everything, and like I said, I any questions that are asked, I tell the employers whatever they ask.
So you've used the word ambiguity several times. Tell me what you mean when you say you've been accused of several ambiguities that wasn't quite true. You used that word several times. I'm just trying to get an understanding of what you mean in your use of it.
Well, because, what I recall being told what to do in that situation by appeals is you have to reveal, the wording is like, you have to reveal your situation to employers. And so when I have to take that and interpret it, I try to ask questions, but a lot of times they don't nail it down to exact points. They don't have to give me a list of we have to reveal this, 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 and this. I mean, so if you say reveal your situation, there's a lock in the situation. You know, I try to reveal that situation. And that's why I'm saying ambiguity. It's just a lot of times I have to question some of these. They tell me instructions that are a little bit gray areas to me. I'm not quite sure exactly what I need to do sometimes, you know. And so I keep questioning, but, you know, a lot of people take questioning as a little offensive, like I'm, saying something about them personally. I'm just trying to clarify situations and trying to know exactly what I got to do. I'm really, really detail-oriented as far as, you know, really wanting to know exactly what I got to do, and I would do that exactly.
So the concern I have is your frustration when, you know, things are not going right or the ambiguities, as you put it. But because of the incident that you actually went to prison for, there was some frustration that was going on with you at the time that incident occurred, which caused you to do what happened. So I'm concerned about how do you weigh those two out between, you know, having frustration with issues that are going on now, and when you had frustration back, like you left California, you came out, you was on your motorcycle, and you're frustrated and somehow wind up at this post office and committing a crime.
Well, I definitely understand, you know, how you connect those things, but in my mind, they're really extremely distantly separated.
Okay.
You know,
explain to me how they're distant.
The crime when I was a teenager involved a lot of different emotions besides frustration alone. I mean, I was just not, I was suicidal myself. I had little respect for life. I had really little empathy. I just had a kid's brain where and then when I got physically fatigued and mentally fatigued from being out here all alone and running out of money and stuff like that, it just all built up. So it wasn't specifically, you know, frustration. The frustration is these days. I'm never, you know, I've grown a totally different person since then. These days I'm very empathetic. You know, I'm fascinated by it and respect life and just a totally different mindset these days. But I am a normal person. I mean, I have, you know, definitely, you know, make mistakes and sometimes in a bit of a bad mood, a bit frustrated, you know. But I definitely try to, you know, I'm in no danger of ever being aggressive or causing any harm. No, absolutely zero. I've overcome that decades ago. I have no violence since I've been out, no criminal activity. Since when I was in, I have no threats, no assaults, nothing. And that's because I decided that I wasn't the path I'm going to take. I really wanted to be a better person. And I changed myself really quickly, decades ago. And I'm absolutely no danger of, and I really, since then, also understand all the mental aspects of really appreciating life and respecting people and not causing harm. I mean, that's something I never will do again. It's caught, you know, create a victim of anything. That would never happen. And so my frustrations these days are just minor day-to-day, you know, things, you know, so in my mind it's very, very different types of situations than when I was a teenager.
Okay. Just one more question. I know that you're doing some counseling and doing some counseling on your own and really working hard to do that, but do you still have suicidal thoughts?
Absolutely not.
No way.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not different ideas. Not since I saw you come to Greater, or I had an opportunity after I committed the crime, that was probably the biggest decision I made. I said, well, I can go ahead and waste my life and end it all, or try to do something better, and that's when I turned myself in. I was like, okay, I accept what I did, and I'm really going to accept whatever the system wants me, and just try to be a better person. There's no sense wasting that, also that little bit of potential, you know. That's absolutely, I'm no cross on that today whatsoever.
All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Neal has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. It's a clarity thing for me, but in this honest disclosure thing, I have trouble understanding if somebody told me that I have to make sure my employer knows my situation. Now, I don't know whether that's a condition of release that you have to do a disclosure or just do common sense, because most places, if you don't make a disclosure, they find out you're gone. I've seen that happen in different places that work. But anyway, you're saying that they're not making it specifically clear. You're the one that's responsible to make sure you behave properly. There's no script that we can write to give you, and there's no responsibility of the DOC to give you the script for disclosure. Generally, I mean, this is the first time, and I, granted, haven't been on the board a real long time, but it's the first time I've ever heard of anybody that had problems understanding that kind of language. I understand a little bit of clarification, but in talking about your release and your conditions and all that versus your time in prison and your crime, I would think that a reasonable person with common sense could be able to understand that full disclosure to your employer means, yeah, I'm a convicted felon, I'm parole, I got a wrist bracelet on, or ankle bracelet on, and I could understand at that point maybe you're not automatically saying, well, I went to prison for murder. Okay, you know, and I understand that. And if they don't ask you, it's sort of don't ask, don't tell. But you seem to have difficulty understanding any part of what you're supposed to disclose to. And I just wanted to get a clarification from you. What would the PO have to say to you so that you know you have to do this when you go to work?
I'm definitely not in confusion about that I have to disclose. The only thing in this particular incident, I've done this in many jobs before. But if you ask me right now, what exactly did you disclose to your first employer? I don't know if I could come up with the exact point of the 10 things. I'm on my ankle bracelet. I didn't know 6 years.
Okay, but that's my point, sir. Right. You know, you say, okay, there's 10 things.
Right.
It's kind of a broad term.
I was trying to get out as much information as possible and talk openly about it. This one particular situation, I revealed all the stuff you said at first. I've been out for 2 years, I'm on parole, I'm on my ankle bracelet, for 26 years in prison. I specifically remember hitting these points, but in that particular situation, I don't remember seeing the exact crime. That's the only thing that happened in this particular situation. I know that I have to reveal it, and I'm totally open to revealing all that stuff all the time. It's just, that mistake in this one was really honed on by the parole office. And I understand that, they have to
do the job. And you see the result of it.
Yes.
You could save a whole lot of frustration and anxiety on your part if told them out up front and they said, oops, we can't do it. Okay, well, thank you, sir.
Yes, sir, Mr. Johnson.
So I just want to do just one follow-up, because you say you tell them and you disclose whatever you have that you have an ankle bracelet, that you've been to prison, you have an ankle bracelet, and you've been incarcerated for 26 years. Is that pretty much, am I wording it right that you said that basically you tell everyone that?
Well, like I said, I don't have a script that I go by. These are natural conversations that I have with HR people. and some of them are resistant to any information, so I have to really try to get out all my points.
So
I try to disclose everything, but I can't. And if they engage in a conversation with me, it usually ends up disclosing way more than I'm not immediately disclosed, because if they're talking to me, and I'm totally open with it.
Okay.
But sometimes when they're not wanting to hear things, you know, I may not want to get 5 of the points instead of 7 of the points that I feel like in my head I really want to tell them, you know. And that's all that happened in this situation was, you know, I disclosed a lot, and I can't tell you exactly, you know, we had a long conversation, but it goes in different directions, and I got out. The points I felt was, I thought I did my job, I thought I had fully disclosed, and then I was reminded by the PO that I didn't, and I understand that. I understand that that's my responsibility, and I'm very clear on that now. Definitely after he said that, that exact point would never happen again, but I'm very clear on that particular detail.
Okay, I thought I heard you say when you were just talking to Mr. Neal that you basically tell him that you on an ankle bracelet, that you've been to prison, you've been incarcerated for 26 years.
Yeah, I tell him I'm on parole, because they're going to get a call.
So,
I have to give their name, whoever the gentleman is, really, and contact information to the parole office. So I give my employers a heads up, I don't want to get a parole call. Hey, you know, you got this guy, I know you're going to get a call. So I talk to them about that, I tell them. They're probably going to get a call from my PO. I tell everyone about that.
Okay.
And then I have a conversation trying to reveal my situation, you know, and reveal everything. It's a natural conversation. I reveal as much as, you know, I can.
Okay, because the reason I ask, I'm just having a hard time sometimes in my mind understanding if you tell someone you've been in prison for 26 years, for them to not ask.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Most times they do,
uh-huh.
And I'm glad about it. It keeps the conversation rolling where I can know that I fully reveal everything. Sometimes they're very resistant to continuing the conversation that way, and I'm trying to make sure I get all my points.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And I just thought of 2 other questions, and I think they'll be brief. One of them is, and I can see your current record from your parole officer, but were you involved with drugs at all?
Absolutely not.
Okay, I don't believe that's true.
That's another decision I made early on in prison, that I would not waste my time and the little potential I might have by doing that.
Okay.
And I have zero. I've been drug tested for
23 years, I think.
All in prison, 2 years out. I have no WUAs,
okay.
No failures, no tickets for drug paraphernalia, nothing.
Okay. That's what I thought your answer would be, but I wanted to ask it on the record. Also, you said you're a detail-oriented person, and I just wanted to hear your experience with your itineraries. Have you had success with your itineraries?
Yes.
Because you're pretty active.
Yes.
You're going out and...
you know, I thought I'd be really good at that. Because I'm that's a really tough thing to do, is schedule like 2 weeks ahead of time and to really, by the way, never make a mistake abiding by that. It's a tough thing, but I've done very well on that. You know, one of my main problems was, like, I wasn't familiar with this area, so initially I was... if I look back now, a bit of a mistake moving all the way out to Gilbert, because there was very little public transportation. One of the conditions of the board settlement was that I cannot have a motor vehicle, so I can't try to pursue that. So I've been taking public transportation for 2 years. And being way out in Gilbert, it's very, you know, it's far away. And the first place I lived, there was only one bus route. There was no east to west, and there was no buses on either. The one road. And so it took me, it's actually 2.5 hours to get to Phoenix, into the parole office, one way. And I had to, you know, so those kind of things with my schedule is tough, because a lot of times the POs, I don't know if they see that a lot, but I've had to really detail out for them, like, here's the bus schedule. It really does take me an hour and a half to get up here to Mesa. This class is 2 hours. It's only a big block of time to be able to do this. You know, it's not, I'm cutting as close as I can with the public transportation. So that part of the scheduling is too difficult, but I'm very diligent at doing it.
Okay. And you live in Mesa now?
I do.
Okay, so you don't have quite the issue.
Right, and okay. I'm definitely half as close as
okay. All right. That sounds good. And did you have any other questions, either of you? No. Okay. We'd like to call your supporters, but given that we have eight people.
They're not all good speakers.
Okay. And I don't know if your attorney.
Yes.
Your attorney or Ms. Ham wants to be the coordinator.
He's not his attorney.
Oh, okay.
An attorney. Support.
All right, so you're going to be the coordinator for who comes up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, board members.
And please state your name.
Thanks. My name is Donna Hamm, and I, first of all, want to make sure that you do have a packet that was turned in, mm-hmm. and there are a number of things that I just would like to touch on that I think are important in this packet that the board should take into consideration here. One, I think it's impressive, especially when you consider just regular people, that on page 18, he shows you that he has gone from 0 to 745 on his credit score. There's a lot of people out in the community that don't have a credit score, 745, so I think it just shows the level of responsibility that Brian has handled, his work, his schedule, and so forth. Also, at the bottom of page 18, he has just a paragraph about what he hopes to do in the future, and I would like to discuss that for just a moment, because moving him to parole, general parole status, is going to have a tremendous positive impact on Brian. First of all, whether you parole him today or not, we are respectfully asking this board to lift the ban on driving so that he can, after 2 years, obtain his driver's license. At the suggestion of his parole officer, he has already taken the preliminary testing, I think the written portion of the test, and so driving would make everything just so much more efficient for him. And I think after 2 years of being in the community, whether he's on parole or not, I think that would be a positive step for this board to lift your, because it was the board, not the Department of Corrections, that originally put no driving as one of the restrictions on him when he was released. I would also like to refer you to page 26 in the packet, which is a letter from Josh Ramsley. Brian has been employed as a cook since December 31st. He consistently arrives on time, keeps a very clean workspace, performs his job duties to our standard. He has excelled in his position, gets along well with our staff, is an overall reliable employee. The next page is another letter from a former employer, Stephanie Tompkinson. He's probably one of the few, if not the only, staff members that all the other staff get along with. And here I think this gives you a clue into the description that he's giving you with some of the people he's actually interviewing with. She says, I, along with two other managers, are the only one that knows the circumstances of Brian's past. So what happens when an ex-felon goes into some of these employers? And it varies. He has told me it varies almost every time he goes to apply for a job. And I have to respectfully disagree with Mr. Neal's assumption that it should be really easy for him to know what he should expect to say. because the Department of Corrections, I requested Ryan's entire field office file from the day he started on parole until they gave me up until July the 6th, so a couple weeks missing records. There's 126 pages here of chrono notes, and this documents every single contact, whether in person, by phone, at his employer, at an off-site location, or in the parole office, every contact or interaction that he's had with any of his assigned parole officers. I did not make five copies of this 126-page document because I did not really expect the board to have the time to go through these thousands of entries that are in this document. But if you will take my word for it, I will give you a few summaries of these comments. One, there is never an instruction in any of these meetings with any of his parole officers that tells him, you have to disclose the following information when you go to employers. And he's worked at several jobs, and he's had several POs. And each one of them, after they approve the job, which they're required to approve it, they do call and they talk to some supervisor that's the contact point, and they just confirm that they're aware. We don't know where that conversation is because all they document in here is that they called so-and-so, the name and the phone number is redacted, and that they have confirmed that they're aware of Brian's status. So that's an ambiguity, because what does that mean? But I will tell you that the Department of Corrections does apparently not leave it to chance when someone on home arrest is renting an apartment, because they have a form that Brian fills out and has to hand to the apartment manager, and that apartment manager has to hand it back. And it says, it's a form like this, a half-page form. And it says, this information that has been revealed about Ryan Buckingham included the current criminal convictions and other relevant information. So there's disclosure in writing required by the Department of Corrections to anyone that he rents an apartment. There's no similar form, and I don't know why they don't make him pay a similar form to an employer. If they're worried about liability, they told Brian, the reason I want you to do this, his most recent PO, none of the others he's had in the past, told him this, but his most recent PO, when they got into the discussion about he didn't disclose enough information, told him, well, this is all about third-party liability. Well, yeah, the third party is the Department of Corrections. They're trying to protect themselves, as is quite understandable, from any liability that might occur if somebody hired him and didn't know he was on supervision and something happened. Well, they do it quite explicitly for apartments, and I don't get, and it doesn't seem reasonable to me, that they don't do that with their people who are out looking for jobs. But that's where the ambiguity began, because Brian was disclosing what he was asked about, his 26 years in prison, the fact he would tell them originally he's on home arrest. Nobody knew what that was. So he would say, okay, parole, because you're going to hear from a parole officer, to make it easy for that understanding to take place to a lay person. You and I and some of the people in this room deal with these terms all day long. We know what they mean. We have a common understanding of them. But not everyone does in the workaday world. So this is only, and you're welcome if you want this 126-page document. you are welcome to look through it, and I will affirm to you, even under oath if I have to, there isn't a single instance in here where he was instructed by any other parole officer to disclose the actual conviction for which he was in prison. That only came about when Butcher, Steve Butcher, who's his current parole officer, began supervising him in March of 2018. Okay? Nothing occurred prior to that that was of any concern to any parole officer. Why? I'm speculating, but probably because they knew they were going to call and follow up with his supervisor and let them know whatever information the parole officer wanted them to have about this employee that was now working for them. So the bottom line is, you know, does Brian have a, I think he has legitimate a reason to be frustrated when the rules change sort of in the middle of the game, 2 years into the game, and unbeknownst to him, the new rule is presented to him as though, well, you must have been wrong. And that's frustrating to someone who is trying to do everything. The other revealing thing in this document is that there are so many positive things. Every schedule he adheres to, every check, and especially since March of 2018, when Mr. Butcher became his supervisor, there have been, I'm going to say, 6 or 8 times that he has conducted an unscheduled contact with the offender. One of the times he actually followed him secretly from his workplace to his home just to check to see if Ryan is where he's supposed to be and is going where he's supposed to go. I'm not sure why he feels he has to do this, because he's got the ankle monitor and that's supposed to tell them, but in any case, he does unscheduled visits both to his work, to his residence, following one day from his workplace to his residence, and there's nothing in violation here. Brian is doing everything he's supposed to do. And I think that this, if you count the one page where there is devoted to the staffing that they had with Brian over this issue of being upset because he was told, I know I'm going to lose my job. It, you know, you're going to tell him my conviction. And everything else is positive in here. And I'd be happy to leave this on record.
You may, however, we have access to that through the department anyway.
So, absolutely.
So I would say probably not necessary.
The other thing I'd like to present to the board this morning is a letter. Brian mentioned that he does go for individual counseling. And the gentleman who is a master's level counselor works for a group called, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Atempus.
Yes.
And his name is Sean Harris. And I'd just like to give you the letter. And there are more, you only need 3 copies. May I give you a copy?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair?
Thank you.
And I'd just like to read a couple of sentences from it. Brian and I have discussed his crime and his sentence and explored his remorsefulness, his acceptance for taking a life, and the significance of his crime and the pain it has caused. Brian has been engaging, cooperative, motivated to reach his treatment goals of increased emotional management, sound decision-making, and commitment to enriching the lives of others as he moves forward. Brian has kept all of his appointments and is working vigorously to reduce his emotional reactivity, and he's made significant progress in doing so. Brian communicates through words and not violence. He is observant and considerate of others while he works with others professionally and while he is engaged in counseling. Ryan has never raised his voice, never used inappropriate language, never provided any reason to believe in session that he is not ready to return home to his family after fulfilling his debt to society. And part of that return home is, as Ryan pointed out to you, when he committed this terrible crime in Arizona, he was passing through Arizona. He knew no one here and still really doesn't have any family here. He's made some friends, but his life and his future is back in Pennsylvania. And if he were to be granted parole, once he was established to be in substantial compliance with the conditions of supervision for parole, his intent is to ask for an interstate compact to go back to Pennsylvania, where he intends to do the things that are marked in his packet, including pursuing his education in music, but also taking advantage of some of the contacts that his family has in construction jobs. I would ask you to when you look at his packet, forget about the letters from his family. They're all wonderful, they love him, they support him, they're going to continue. Look at the letters from his employers, who they don't have any skin in the game. They don't have any reason that they have to feel obligated to write a letter in support. They have all, without question, written supportive letters discussing his character, his behavior, his reliability, his steadiness, his willing to work. And those are found on pages 26, 27, 45. And then you have one on page 52 from a program director at Carla Vista Sober Living, who says he's a role model for the other guys who came to that house. And this was just after, this was his first living arrangement when he first got out. So I think overall, we're asking you to look at the overall record of 2 years on home arrest supervision. We're asking you to move him to the next step, which is general parole, which obviously still includes supervision. We're asking you to grant him the ability to drive, whether you vote in his favor today or not, because that will move him one step in terms of easing his ability to get around in a town that is still, it's better, but it's still difficult and lengthy to get around without an automobile. And we're asking you to consider that all of his conditions, his adherence to his schedule, his lack of substance abuse or any kind of violations, his participation in programming and completion of programming, everything he's been asked to do, he has done and excelled. And I would like to reserve some time, if necessary, at the end of the hearing to respond to any remarks that may need to be responded to for clarification. If the board has any questions?
Any questions, Mr. Hall?
I wouldn't ignore him. When you were talking, I wouldn't, at his hearing in January, there was on the board paperwork, there was no indication of more vehicle restrictions from the last hearing. And the normal conditions for use, and usually even when we put the condition on there, we need the discussion up to the PO, but the copy of the hearing notes that I have from January 9th, 2018. Okay, but I'm talking about. The hearing notes that we weren't in the hearing do not have that indicated.
Right. Those are from the original home arrest hearing when he was originally granted.
It may not operate a motor vehicle, but it is normally up to the PO to say you're ready. But very seldom. And what I'm saying is, we didn't mark it on here, so we didn't put that restriction on him. at that time.
Mr. Neal will address that today.
Yeah, so I will address that.
Just for
my only point is the commission's confusion on who's
original.
Okay, well, I mean, what I was going to say is that there could be some confusion on when it can be lifted and everything. And why I think normally it's up to the PO, and that's the way a lot of stuff is written.
I understand. Just a clarification. Brian has been informed that because it was on his original restrictions, that it's up to the board to lift the restrictions.
Okay, so I'm going to react the first time you
chooses okay. not to lift it until
we address it.
And that's why we're asking you.
Okay.
For more clarification, I would like to
thank you
again. Argument.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Okay. Would you, in light of the fact that we need to keep moving, and we have many, many people to speak, so
okay.
if we could ask people to try to limit your remarks and not repeat something that someone else has said, that
okay.
we would appreciate that very much. So I will just let you kind of
okay.
determine an order.
Come on up. Just for the record, in case we do have to cut things short, you have very powerful and detailed letters from Brian's mother, from his stepmother, his father, and his
yeah.
aunt and uncle, who are all present in the room. So I would ask you to reiterate
right.
what is written in those
right.
letters.
We have more than 30 letters.
Okay,
so.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be
oh,
here.
Sir, please state your name.
My name is Jay Michael. F-L-O-U-R-N-O-Y.
Thank you.
I'm from Flagstaff, Okemo County. I was a county attorney for 8 years in Okemo County, and then the next 16 years before I became a Superior Court judge, I practiced law. I retired as a Superior Court judge, and currently, I'm still an active member of the bar, 57 years. I'm not being paid to be here. I'm here because I was one of Ryan's attorneys at the time of the plea sentencing in Mojave County, Kingman. And I want you to know that Brian, you may not remember this, Brian wasn't arrested. He turned himself in. He was remorseful from the time I met him. The plea was agreed upon. The people from Valentine, I'm sure there's some of them here, had an opportunity to give their thoughts by meeting with the county attorney, and then by meeting with the probation department, and then at sentencing, they had a say. And there's still sorrow. I understand their sorrow. But Brian has been a model person, and he, as you know, he got out of 25 years. I assumed that he would probably be put on general parole at that time, but I wasn't acquainted with how this goes on because I haven't really done any post-conviction things. But anyway, he appeared here without an attorney the first time, and he was sent back to prison for years. So he's got 26 years of hard time. But let me remind you that he has about 150 hours of collegiate work, probably more hours than most of the people here. I have a doctorate, and I think that Brian has more hours than I have. He has an associate's degree from Rio Salado College. He's been a person at work. When he got out, he's always trying to get a job. When this first happened, I think the board was somewhat at fault by not keeping addresses and employers. Maybe you have to advertise this or put in, but for some reason, a lady got fired from IHOP because she gave a letter of recommendation to Brian. And there was all of this is after Brian left IHOP. He then went into Cocopah. He's been working there. But he has he's shackled, ankle bracelets. He can't drive. He can't do anything. I think his best friend's a cat. he has a cat and blind with the given. And you need to put him on a general parole and then let him work and see if he can earn the right to go to Pennsylvania. Now, he has support, because look in this first row. There's a father, there's a mother, there's a stepmother, there's an aunt, and there's another person or two. I got delayed by trains. I don't know who's there. And I can't see real well at this time of my life. But anyway, I understand what happened. But it's not major. Put yourself in that position. You know, you're trying to get a job, if you just go in and you just, you got to try to smooth it over. And he was wrong. And he was written up for it. But certainly that isn't a reason to keep him from a general parole. And so I'm not going to waste your time, but I want you to know that I'm unpaid. I'm here because I believe in Brian. And I think he'll do an excellent job in society. I think there's things to come. You know, rarely does anyone serve 25 years of hard time or 26 years of hard time. And 2 years of intensive, whatever it is, parole with the ankle braces, and do as well as he did. And I congratulate him. And I hope you have the mercy to give him a general parole. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for... Thank you, sir.
Hey, I think we're okay. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, great. Okay. Thank you. All right. Mr. Butcher, is Mr. Butcher? I didn't see you back there. I apologize.
That's all right. Well, good morning. My name is Steve Butcher. I'm the community correctional officer for Mr. Buckingham.
Okay. And I know you can't make a recommendation, but is there anything you'd like to tell us about anything about Mr. Buckingham's supervision?
He's been compliant. Or he would not be in this circumstance today.
Here.
We would arrest him. It's zero tolerance for home arrest. I can touch base regarding, I guess, seems to be the focus of most of the conversation today about the incident he had regarding disclosure. It's just not Mr. Buckingham. It's everyone in general who was committed to felon. It's very difficult to find jobs. It's difficult to comply with disclosure as required by the Department of Corrections. And it's frustrating, sometimes humiliating. And yes, people are discriminated against because they're a felon, and rightfully so. I mean, you do lose certain rights. So it's not a point that it was being a dead horse. It was addressed. We moved on. He knows what's expected of him, I believe. If not, we'll address it again. So he seemed to be complying, doing what he needs to do. That's a recommendation. You'll never get that from the
Department. Well, no, we would never ask for that. We would not ask for such a thing. Do either of you have a question? Mr. Neal.
Yes, sir. On the dead horse, my issue was with not the non-disclosure part, but when he had to do it, and he worried about God, and he had negative attitude. It was called negative attitude. My concern is the, you know, the attitude, that, you know, does he, does it look like he's more out of line with attitude than anybody else would be. Because, you know, that's one of our concerns is community safety. And if he's prone to bursts of, you know, hot bursts of anger, that's not a good thing. But if he's, you know, just gets a bad attitude, then I mean, a lot of people get a bad attitude, and you say, hey, this looks like, oh, okay, and it's totally wrong. So, but the way it's written, I'm concerned about his attitude.
It would not be annotated and noted had it not been noteworthy. It definitely was a concern, and that's why it was noted. It wasn't as pleasant as Mr. Buckingham has indicated, and he wasn't as forthright as he has indicated either. So, obviously, I have a different perspective on it. And that's okay. We can have different perspectives. It's not a violation of his rule for me and him to disagree. But obviously, he does need to do what's required for the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Yeah. That's a concern. And I will accept what you say. I appreciate your honesty. And I know you're kind of a hard taskmaster
on the people out there. You make them follow the rules. That's a hard thing to do.
It is sometimes difficult. I know he's had multiple POs. I can't speak for past POs. However, you know what I need to do as a parole officer, and it may not always be the same as what he's used to. But again, I didn't write the policy, and I'm here to enforce it.
All right, thank you, sir. Any questions, Mr. Jones?
Yes, sir. I'll just add one question, because the only thing that bothers me by that was that in the report it says that he caught the attitude and got aggravated. So it had to be counseled as a result. So that was my concern, was the interaction with the PO, and there was a statement made that he didn't feel like he had to disclose.
That is correct. Rehashing the whole situation, basically, I gave him permission to do some onboard training with this company. And had he, successfully completed this onboard training, he could potentially get a job offer. During one of my normal contacts with him, he disclosed that he was hired. And of course, I previously told him he has to make disclosure. He's got to report that he's a felon, he's on home arrest, he's supervised by the Department of Corrections, and that I will be contacting the employer to verify such. So it's no secret, and no, I don't annotate everything in my promo notes that I talk to offenders about. So when I talked to Mr. Buckingham, it was, he told me no, he did not disclose, that he indicated on his application that he was a felon, and they did the background check, so he assumed that it was okay. And I told him, no, that's not the procedure. You know the procedure. I am going to be contacting someone. You need to make disclosure first. It's not my job to make disclosure. I verify that you made disclosure. So it went back and forth, and obviously I know why he's upset. Same reason everyone gets upset, because a lot of times they're going to get fired, and that's exactly what happened in the circumstance. He made disclosure. I called and verified that he made disclosure. His employer said, pleasant. He made disclosure. No issues how he made it or anything. The problem is, corporate doesn't want to employ someone with that type of background.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Well, thank you, Mr. Butcher.
Okay.
We appreciate it.
We'll be in the bail.
Okay, thanks.
Now, Jeff, just before we go on, I have to respond to some of this because it completely contradicts what I just read to you from documents that show there is no policy. It's not in writing. It is an ambiguity that is communicated verbally, and it is very reasonable that each different offender could interpret it a different way. If I have a felony record and I fill out a job application and I check the box that says, yes, I have a felony, that might mean to me disclosure, and especially if they come back and offer me a job after I check the box, because one assumes quite reasonably that having checked the box, yes, that a background check was conducted and it was acceptable to whoever conducted the background check. Now, if he's given a list, which he now has been given after this conversation, and has to disclose the conviction, the length of time, the fact that he's wearing an ankle bracelet, that's a different story. But prior to this incident with Mr. Butcher, that conversation had not taken place with this kind of detail with any prior parole officer. And I would invite you to look through all 126 pages of those promo notes. It isn't there. And Mr. Butcher says, I don't put everything in my promo notes. Well, they put discussions about things like going to get a smoothie and whether Brian bought a cat at the Humane Society. So I'm guessing if they gave him a directive in the past to disclose his actual conviction and details about it, that would have been put in the promo notes.
Mr. Jones.
I don't want to debate this issue, but I do want to say that it's my understanding that Mr. Buckingham admitted that he knew that he had to disclose, that he knew he had to disclose. The only question that came up was whether he disclosed whether they wanted to have a conversation about it. I don't want to debate it. But it's my understanding, and I could be wrong in him, but my understanding is Mr. Buckingham, it says that he knew that he had to disclose, that he had to say that he was on parole, that he had to tell him that his parole officer was going to be contacting him, that he had to do those things. So that's whether it's in the quantum notes or not, he's admitting that he's aware and he understands that. However, that doesn't seem to be what the situation is, you know, whether what happened when he did a job or that argument in between them, that he understood that, he was advised of that. You know, his interpretation of what he said he knew is understandable. I'm not quite understanding this issue that you're debating when he's admitted that he's already been advised and he knew. He said that he knew he had to disclose. He knew he had to tell him that he was on parole. He knew he had to tell him that his parole officer was going to be contacting him. That he knew that. So I just don't know why we're still going.
Well, Mr. Johnson, I think he did say he checked the box, which is disclosure, and that he did tell that he was on supervision. He didn't mention what his crime was for, and that was the single issue that was the disagreement between Mr. Butcher and Mr. Buckingham, is he didn't disclose the actual crime for which he served time in prison was convicted.
Well, that's not what he just said. I think what Mr. Butcher said is that when he asked Mr. Buckingham if he disclosed, he said he checked the box that he was a felon, but he did not disclose the rest of the information. And so, but that's not, I mean, we're just debating the issue that's really, I mean, Mr. Buckingham has said it's not a, you know, you're making more out of an issue than I think that even Mr. Butcher, when he came up and stated, you know, related that this is an issue that kind of goes through what most people on parole go through.
And which Mr. Buckingham has been through. The only reason we focused on it is because the board has focused a lot of questions and attention on this issue. And we'd just like to make sure that Brian's side is on the record and is being considered so that you can make an informed decision about whether this particular incident is serious enough to deny him general parole.
Well,
that's the concern.
Okay. He's made a statement on what he thought. I mean, he's been very clear and understandable and answered, you know, all questions, you know, about that. So
my job is an advocate.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Neal.
My only issue with that subject was his attitude in response to it, and that's why I was questioning the whole instance, is this, you know, because the attitude and an outbreak of anger and stuff like that is a very serious issue for us to consider. Not, but, you know, whether or not he disclosed everything he's supposed to, because that's the trigger. And I really don't think he was trying to imply that because he, you know, wasn't told this or all that stuff, that, and he had that problem, that was a justification for, you know, for having the attitude or the outbreak. You know, that okay, the outbreak means nothing because you have this excuse, and it's the outbreak that has to be concerned with, you know.
And Mr. Butcher did say that his opinion of it and description of the incident was different than Brian's, because as you recall, Brian described
it. But it was still the attitude and, you know, the reactions and all that stuff.
Right.
You know, could have been over something totally different. And I think we covered it, and Mr. Officer Butcher, my explained way, but pretty much said that, you know, well, okay, and he was okay with it. You know, it's not something serious enough to really worry about. Okay.
Okay.
I think we're going to move on now. Is anyone else, did anyone else want to speak on behalf of Mr. Buckingham? Yeah, there'll be another opportunity at the end. Okay. All right, so now we'll turn to representatives of the victims. And I don't know who, would someone in particular like to go first, or? Thank you for coming. coming today and welcome. Could you please state your name?
My name is Sean Weiss.
Thank you. And what would you like to tell the board?
I'm Jacqueline Griggs' youngest daughter, and I have been here a few times now requesting that you keep Mr. Buckingham in custody. I cried, I've sobbed, I've begged that this man not be released. There's no reason that he should be forgiven. What he did was planned. He knew what he was doing. He was 19 years old. He wasn't a child. We're going to take a chance at letting this person out, and that he's going to commit a similar crime or maybe even worse. I, as a mother and a grandmother, I don't want to go to IHOP or anywhere else that this person may be working, or anyone else that's committed a crime like this. I fear for my family's safety. And as you stated, he's been frustrated, he's been angry, and I guess it's hard for me to understand why anyone would want him released, him, his family, anyone in general, because you're just going to take the chance that this is going to happen again. In my mind, there's no forgiveness for this type of act. I would not forgive my own child or grandchild if they did this, or any family member for that matter. I'm a very straightforward, honest person. And I believe this man, years ago, should have paid more dearly than he has. There's not enough time spent in prison or anywhere else to excuse what he did. Now he is out in society and he's complaining that he has to take a bus for an hour. So why? That should not be a complaint. He should be happy he gets to ride a bus. He should be happy that he gets to have a cat and be in society. A couple times ago when I was here, he had got frustrated in prison because they asked him to go back to his cell and he didn't go because he wanted to still make his tea. Why do we allow killers these accommodations and these luxuries? He did a horrible thing. And I remember in the very first trial when I was here, he had absolutely no remorse for what he did. The head chairman asked him if he had remorse, and he said no. He had no feelings. He didn't get sick after he did it. Now all of a sudden he has remorse. We've changed him. Well, that doesn't change what he did. He killed my mother. I was 16 years old. There is absolutely no reason that this man should be released. And I beg of you. And I know there's other criminals out there, and I wish I could go and speak at every one of these hearings and beg and plead and pray that they're not released out into society. My son-in-law was in the military for 8 years. He was a Marine. He was to Afghanistan twice. He's seen people get killed, blown up, everything that you could imagine. We teach these young men and women in our military not to have feelings and emotions so that they can go and fight for our freedom. But yet we have people here that kill intentionally, and you don't have to teach them to do it. You don't have to teach them not to care. It's just the way they are. But yet we fight and we try to change them and make them a part of our society. But yet we have these men and women that serve every day for our country, and they suffer every day. Their families suffer for what they had to see and do. I mean, please, just think about your own families and our family, and please do not let him without any set type of supervision. Thank you very much for
your time. Any questions for Ms. Weiss? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome. Please state your name.
My name is Wanda Easter.
Thank you. And what would you like to tell the board?
As you may imagine, just before I get started, this is much more difficult for us than the other side. It's much more difficult to relive this over and over. And for us, it's still about what happened, to some degree. But it's also about what could happen in the future. You can see this, some of you have been here before. You've watched this age. You've seen my father before he had a stroke. And now we go through today. And this all just adds to it. My name's Lorna Easter, and I'm the middle child of the victim, Jackie Grigg. I would like to ask that you consider what I have to say today, as I feel that when we come here, the board allows us to speak, but doesn't truly focus on what we have to say. As we, nor our mother, are the concern. I think this has been one of the hardest things for me to face. This is not about my mother, my family, or what was done to my mother. It's all about Brian Buckingham now. He has become the victim. I feel that these proceedings have one goal, and that goal is not justice, nor the good of society. It's about helping Brian Buckingham and giving him a chance. Therefore, with that in mind, I would like to ask that you take into account the following when you make your decision today. Brian Buckingham has been out on an ankle bracelet for close to 2 years. In that time, what has he done to show that he values the opportunity he has been given and is a productive member of society? And yes, I know you've heard he's held a cook job, I believe, for 6 months now. He's job hopped, he's got an apartment, and he's got a cat. How many jobs has he had? Is he currently employed? I believe he's been terminated more than once. I'd like to take a moment to read from this same report that everyone keeps talking about. It's the Brian Buckingham 08-4967 progress report, as we are allowed to have access to that. Although we struggle continually to get the documents, we asked prior to this proceeding for the parole packet. We don't get it. We're told there's rules. We have to follow the rules. The letters come late. We have to call and get the dates. We call the phone numbers. They transfer us somewhere else because they don't even know why we're here. We were told it's a public hearing. Anyway, let me read for a moment. Early July 2017, subject was employed as a dishwasher. The offender quit this employment after locating other employment as a cook. This employment continued until he was fired on 11-24-17. It was determined that the subject was fired due to performance issues. Upon the subject's termination, it was reported by, this is all redacted, so I have blanks, that the offender stormed out of the kitchen and yelled, "Goodbye, everyone, I was just fired." He then got on his bike, rode off, and yelled back, "You are all stupid liars." And it appeared the subject flipped off the manager as he rode off on his bike. In January 2018, the offender secured near full-time employment as a cook, and this employment continues today. On 5-15-18, the subject reported to his assigned parole officer that he had been hired on with as a maintenance worker. The subject had been seeking a job closer to his home with hopes to get more hours and better pay. The subject was asked by the parole officer if he made proper disclosure to his new employer that he was a felon and on supervision status as required, and he indicated that he had not. He was then advised he must do so, and the parole officer would verify such as required by ABC procedures. The subject then got agitated and caught an attitude with his assigned parole officer and explained he doesn't feel he has to make disclosure and states he'll just be fired. The subject was explained the necessity of disclosure and the rules of supervision, and the subject continued to have a bad attitude and, in general, very bitter demeanor. Just two examples of the same anger issue that has been occurring since 1990, when three times he returned to the site of the small post office and waited until my mother was alone and shot her. Three times. Is violating any of the conditions of his release? Is he checking in when he's supposed to? I understand the ankle device went dead twice before previous hearings. We have all heard what a stellar prisoner he was, and all the successes with certificates, etc. What has he done to better himself now that he is out in society and not in a controlled environment? I do not believe that Brian Buckingham shows remorse, nor does he take responsibility for his actions. He did not want to murder my mother, and he still does not today. I do not believe that he possesses the feelings that a normal, mentally stable person does. I have heard prior board members ask him if when he realized what he had done, when he shot her and stepped over her while she was dying to steal her meager belongings, did he get outside and think, oh, what have I done? Did he get physically ill? The answer is no, he did not. I believe that he still blames the world for everything that happens to him to this day, whether it be why he murdered her or why he lost his most current job, it's always someone else's fault. If he cannot take responsibility, how can he change his behavior? In addition, if he does not change his behavior, why is he released into society? He still has no answer when asked why he killed her. He wasn't angry with her. Prior people would ask him, did you have an altercation with her? The response was, no, she was kind. So can it be inferred that he does not know why? How will he be able to prevent himself from acting again? If you don't know why you do something is wrong, and if you don't even recognize it as a wrong, how do you stop it? I was not here last time, and I apologize. Some of this is similar to what my sister said, but we didn't write them together, which is ironic, maybe. I was not here last time because I was helping my niece and her husband move home as he's getting out of the Marines. He served our country twice in Afghanistan. When he came home, he couldn't eat. He can't sleep. For days at a time, the boy stays awake. He generally has a stressed attitude, seeking counseling and help. All because of what he had to see and do while he was there. I believe that this is probably a very normal reaction from a human being who's had to inflict or watch death be inflicted on another human being. Brian Buckingham has never expressed the same issues. I believe today is the first day, and I've been to, I don't know how many of these hearings now, five, as many as there are except the last one. The first time I've ever heard tears. We must be learning. I believe the only reason he feels any remorse is for himself. It's an honorable quality to want to help people. But I believe those you are trying to help should deserve it and not be a threat to society. I believe that Brian Buckingham is not only a drain on society, but he's a danger. And that the harder his life becomes outside, the more dangerous he will become. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions? Can you start? No? Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for coming. Please state your name.
My name is Renee Gray. I'm the oldest daughter of Jackie Gray. So far, I haven't missed one. We as a devastated family 28 years ago took advice of professionals in positions of power. We did not fight a plea agreement. My sister was 16. My other sister was 20. I myself was 26 with two young children. We lived in a small community of Valentine, Arizona. They told us 25 years was life. We didn't understand that in 25 years, every 6 months, we would go through the same hell. Maybe that's what you get when you live in a simple community, a simple country of folks, and you work hard for a living, and you do the right thing, and you do the right thing by fellow men. You never expect someone to come through your little town where your mom and dad were married as high school sweethearts and murder your mother 75 yards from your home at a post office for $40 in cold blood. With no reasonable advice when we're devastated and truly believe life was life. Now, here we are every 6 months for Brian Buckingham's progress reports. When I spoke last hearing at the Board of Executive Clemencies, for the reasons I will give you now, on August 15, 1990, after the tragedy we suffered, and continue to care with us each day, I made the comment to my mother's memory, commitment to my mother's memory, to come each time and do my best to see that justice be done with Brent Buckingham. As we all come together today, though, I realize this is not about my family, nor my mother, nor the heinous act that was committed by Brian Buckingham. If it was, we would have never been subjected to this kind of torture in the first place. Brian Buckingham, had we had the knowledge we have today, we would have fought for him to have the death penalty. There was premeditation, and it was the heinous enough crime. We would have fought against the plea agreement, but we didn't know. He would have received, if we could have held it in our power, the death penalty that he deserved. We are here today for the sole purpose of Brian Buckingham's rehabilitation progress. We are not here because he has mental disorders. We are not here because he is insubordinate to his parole officer, displaying his ongoing anger issues that have not been cured in the last 28 years. Clearly giving me indication that rehabilitation for Brian Buckingham has become stagnant. Each time I come to one of these hearings, there's more, it's more egregious, and it becomes worse every time when he doesn't get his way. It has been made clear to us many times we are here as within a school meeting for a third grade child. How many certificates did you get, Brian? Did you remember to charge your ankle monitor, Brian? Brian, did you remember to tell your current employer you're on an ankle monitor, house arrest, and a first-degree murderer? Oops, nope. Let's ignore the rules because I am Brian Buckingham. I will be insubordinate to my parole officer and do this repeatedly because I didn't get it my way and I'm angry again. I will lie at multiple jobs, even though I have been told the rules. But guess what? It's okay. They are out to rehabilitate me at any cost. Wait, could the cost of this rehabilitation be another life? Is it my spoiled behavior? Is my spoiled behavior mirroring that of when I committed first-degree murder? Why, yes, it is. But once again, the bleeding hearts will rehabilitate me at the expense of whoever's next. So you understand, I, Renee Gregg, am here today to see what you can once again do again for Brian Buckingham, because you have never done anything for us, and it is with a heavy heart, I know it probably won't happen today. The public, many innocent people are at your mercy, yet you take your jobs as if you were dealing with a man who took candy from babies. He suffers no consequences for current behavior, the same behavior he has never been rehabilitated of. He did something that can't be reversed. I hope you can outlive with the system and outcomes that everyone creates today, because we as a family certainly have had to. My sister states, can you be 100% sure of his actions once he is released? No, you cannot. He killed once, acting in the same manner he currently does. And guess what? It's my belief he'll do it again. Thank you for your time. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Buckingham, we're coming toward the end of your hearing. If there's no one else who wishes to speak. We're coming toward the end, and we want to give you the opportunity to make a final statement or have a statement made on your behalf.
Sure.
Whichever you choose, or both. Thank you, sir. And just restate your name, please.
Brian Buckingham.
Thank you.
I
Just to clarify a couple points, not to go on and on. I've never been principal lieutenant parole officer. I've had early systems. There's been two other parole officers in here on my hearings that said I was easy to get along with. They had no problem with it. My current parole officer, because I'm compliant, I don't have any problem. There's one incident where there's a different of interpretations, and it was never that I felt privileged or that I'm not supposed to disclose anything. My frustration and that attitude, if you want to use that word, was never anger or anything of that nature. My frustration was just kind of being accused of something I felt I was complying with, but being told I wasn't. So it wasn't that I was, somebody was telling me something and I was saying, well, do I need to do that? It was just, I felt I had done what I was supposed to do and was being criticized for not quite doing enough or something. So I was just a little confused on that. And I have always been remorseful and, you know, I'm very sorry. I've put the great standing for this. I mean, you know, I can understand getting more forgiveness or, you know, but I can't ask for that. I can only do what I can do, which is try to atone in whatever way I can. That's what I tried to do. That would always be with me. That's been a driving force in the actions of my life since that incident. I also want to apologize to my family. You know, I've been through so much stuff. They continue to support me. I'm tired of being a burden. I hope the board will really see that overall I am really ready to be able to join the parole because I'm tired of being a burden on the state, on my family. I really want, when a guy helped me move, he said something that really stuck with me. He was like, don't worry about it, asking him to move because he has a truck. He says, people ask me all the time. I was like, that is so cool, man. I wish I could, not be the one that's a burden, but be the one that has a truck to help somebody else. I mean, that's what I want to get to, and that's what I'm on the path to do. So I hope the board will see that I'm on that path and run the general floor so I can continue and focus on my long-term plans of getting interstate compact and really developing a concrete foundation in my life to be help and to be not be this burden. So that's all I can say. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. All right.
Madam Chair, I'll keep this very, very brief. It's heartrending to listen to the victims' families in all of these kinds of hearings. And the board has an enormous responsibility to take into account not just the victim's point of view, but the interest of the public, and of course the offender's rights, which are protected under our system of government. And you have a statute, when you consider general parole, that governs your decision making. And I would just urge you to rely on that statute, 31.412A, which tells you that in order to make a finding of general parole, you have to find that there is a substantial probability that the offender will remain at liberty without violating the law. And I believe that during the 2 years and the record you have before you, that Ryan Buckingham has demonstrated a substantial probability of not violating the law through all of his behavior, taking into account on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamlin. Okay, Mr. Buckingham, the board is going to go into discussion. You've had these hearings before, and so you understand. And so while the board's in discussion, I just ask you and everyone in the room to just remain silent, and we'll be back shortly. The board is now in discussion. This is a very difficult case. As Ms. Ham just said, I certainly find the victim's testimony very heart-wrenching. I can't imagine being in that situation, and it must just be terrible. This is the second time I've met Mr. Buckingham, and I remember from last time noting that he had started. He explained that he moved far away, not knowing the area and not understanding about public transportation. And has worked hard to make things better for himself so he can be able to get around. And I do understand that. He's trying to comply with this parole officer and be able to go to treatment, which he's doing on his own voluntarily, to be able to go to treatment and not have it take a 2.5-hour bus trip either way. So that part, I certainly appreciate his efforts in that. It sounds like little by little over time, Mr. Buckingham has made some positive steps to include improving his credit score and become active in the community. When you're in prison for 26 years, you don't get that interaction. Trying to learn how to interact with the public and others. He has been very good and compliant on his itinerary, which I think most people would find a pretty difficult task, because you do have to be very, very accurate with that. And that's one of the features of being on home arrest. He was 19 years old when he committed this crime. He described today, again, his mindset at the time. And I remember that's the way he described it last time, too. I don't think anything has changed in his description. He did turn himself in. Has completed programming. I definitely think that this time we should, and I will certainly be one of the three voting members, I think we should allow driving. I think that is something that he definitely should be afforded. I could also be open to general parole, but I would open it up for discussion to fellow board members. Mr. Johnson.
I just wanted to say a couple things off the record that it is not the goal of this board to see that injustice is done to anybody, whether it's the victim or whether it's the person accused of a crime. And we do look at what the good of society is and what's going to happen and try to evaluate on the information that we have whether there's a substantial probability that the person may not commit a crime once they are actually released back into society. We do understand and realize that for the victims of the families that this is a hard thing to go through, and I think that families go through this type of loss is just devastating to the family. And I do not want to make it seem as though we ignore that. The issues that I have with this is that according to Mr. Buckingham's testimony, he came to Arizona and he was frustrated or in a different state of mind, and as a teenager, he was 19 years old, he came here, and without any provocation, committed this murder, and walked in and shot and killed this victim without any resistance or reasons or something that provoked it. I don't know what caused that to happen, but what bothers me about this is that, and I've asked him a couple of questions about being frustrated and how he deals with frustration, and he's attended some anger management and he's attended some program, although he has done some good things outside of that. Now, just prior to his last hearing, he had the incident on his job where he was terminated and displayed some frustration and reportedly flipped off the manager and walked in and told the people that he was being terminated and that they were all liars, is the allegation that was made, and we continued him on home arrest at that time. Now this, now again, just prior to this hearing, he displayed the same frustration with his parole officer and the conversation that they were taking place, whether to disclose or not disclose, and what information that he actually knew he did. But what concerns me is that parole officer says how aggravated that he actually got and that he caught the attitude and state he doesn't feel like he really had to disclose, but just the attitude that he got with the frustration of the parole officer, had it not been for that same type of frustration or reasoning for the original crime, I would be probably a little more understanding. But there's an anger problem that I think has to be dealt with, and I think that that needs to be controlled, and I'm not supportive of releasing him back, you know, off of home arrest. However, I would continue him on his home arrest status, and I would be in agreement with the driving. But my reasons for not granting him regular parole is just the incidents that just keep happening. You know, one incident happened prior to his last hearing, and then we had another display of anger, frustration, whatever terminology you may want to put with it, that happened again prior to this hearing. And I would think that he knows that he has to have these hearings. He knows that he's going to come before this board. That would be something that you would want to work on prior to coming coming to this board. So that's where I'm at, but I'm willing to listen to the rest of my colleagues.
Okay, Mr. Neal.
Thank you. This is a tough one. Having been a victim and in that position myself, I can understand the side of the victim. Sitting on board, I understand what the intent of the criminal justice laws are, and that's to rehabilitate and to deter. So we have laws, and we violate it. There are more laws based on 80s old moral attitudes. If somebody breaks law, they go through the criminal justice system. That's supposed to be assigned to other people, not you or else. But the person going through the system, the intent is to try to rehabilitate offenders and return them to society. And in doing so, a lot of victims are disappointed with the system. But it's a tough one to weigh out and do it. One of the comments from the victim side was that, you know, they have to come in for 6 months. And I've been there, done that. And it drags everything back up. And not that it ever settles out, but it starts to settle down and it comes again. And unfortunately, with home arrest, we usually don't go to 1 year or so up. But the thing I think that is missed sometimes in the overall healing process for both sides is that you look, look at the situation if we were to vote to give Mr. Buckingham regular parole, we would need more hearings. So the victims were needed for all that dragging it up every 6 months or every year. It doesn't alleviate their concerns about him being returned to society, but those who tied out of it, if you take him off home left, he can apply for interstate contact and probably would get it. Because he does have a, overall, he has a criminal case record under home arrest. And many would need to be in the state. That also doesn't alleviate the fact that the loved one was taken away from him when this really happened. So it is really, really tough. But I'll be honest, based on the relief it could give victims on one side, not having dragged it up every 6 months, they can concentrate more on the grieving process and be able to move on with it. And Mr. Buckingham will still be closely supervised. He's going to come off home arrest under maximum supervision and rules for. And you know, the PO decision on that, and also we can, you know, put the heavy amount when he drives on the PO, so, because we don't see him on a day-to-day basis. So we put all this together and try to come up with a balanced decision. I think at this time I would be in favor of the regular parole for many reasons, but again, Mr. Buckingham, an opportunity to. Move more into a rehabilitated state and it would relieve some of the agony of the victims having to drag it up and rehash it every 6 months. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. You certainly, I appreciate our discussions very much, and you bring a unique perspective to this board, having been a victim yourself. And the fact that today the victims raised the issue of coming here every 6 months, you're absolutely correct. They wouldn't have to do that.
It's true. And I've seen it several times with next and second sentence. They're worried about the closer getting out, but when you go back and take your sentence from a life sentence, oh, they got to go back to a life sentence in order to get out. And, you know, so I'm trying to lay the whole thing out. And like I said, it's a little bit later with Mr. Buckingham we're talking about. I think Peter Richard says something totally with the idea that it wasn't really out there, you know, where you got to worry about if they're going to go out to their job and have this disclaimer or hurt somebody and things like that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Neal. Any other comments, Mr. Benson? Okay, thank you. I'm going to make a motion then, and I'm going to move to grant 412A general parole to Brian Buckingham, and I don't know if there's anywhere we can write in here, but that would include the potential to drive at the discretion of the parole officer. So that will be my motion.
Second.
I disagree.
Okay. Seconded by Mr. Neal and disagreed by Mr. Johnson. Now, at this point, I think I am not versed on what the procedure is, since I am a fill-in chairman today. I believe...
You got a majority, so it
passed. I think unless we have a split vote.
You do about two. You have 2-1.
It's 2-1. I am not sure.
I am not sure about that.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Hamm.
It's a violent offense. You need 3 votes.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah.
I believe that is correct.
Yeah, okay.
So could I have a counter motion, I guess? That's what I will ask for.
I would make a motion to continue Mr. Buckingham on home arrest, but I would also want to give him the privilege to be able to drive his motor vehicle's driving privileges.
So just to clarify, your motion is to grant home arrest and deny
absolute discharge.
In 412A?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, sorry. Okay, so that's a motion from Mr. Johnson. I'll second. All right, and agreed by Mr. Neal. Okay, so, and that is the release type granted is home arrest, and release type denied is 412A and 411. And specifically, I'm going to make a note on here that the requirement of lifting, I'm going to make a specific note that driving is permitted at the discretion of the parole officer. Okay, follow our mandatory conditions and sanctions. Random tests for drugs and alcohol, you're already doing that, I believe. I'm going to say may, and I'm going to cross out not, may operate as a motor vehicle at PO's discretion. May operate. Okay. No contact with victim and family. And supervision fee, $65. Okay, so Mr. Buckingham, if you want to come up to the, you heard the board's discussion, sir, and there's still some concern about anger, so that'd be something to think about over the next part of your life here. But the board completely understands about the ability to get around. And so we definitely would want to make sure that you have the ability to get a car, sir.
Thank you.
So we continue on home arrest and see you again. And if you work on those things, that would benefit you, I believe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And thanks to everyone. And I just want to remind supporters of Mr. Buckingham to go out through this door over here, and the victim supporters to go out this door.
Should we wait in the airport?
That would be a good idea. If the Mr. Buckingham supporters just wait, and we'll allow the victim supporters to exit. And thanks again to everyone for participating in the hearing today. The hearing is concluded. Mr. Johnson, can you show up?